the Indie Week on the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Reading for a blind and print-impaired audience, I am John Federson, formerly known as the Honorable John Federson. And today, we're back in our usual studio at the rear portion of the Pro Shop at Jungle Fun, the only miniature potting course featuring real raccoons. Our entertainment today, Raul and Ethel, will stroll out now. Thank you, folks. And we'll get into our current issue, dated February the 26th, 2020. And the opening column today by Alexis Pauline Gums. No rest for the dead. Even in the grave, black people aren't immune to the struggle in Durham. When it rains, it floods, at least in Beechwood Cemetery. Water clouds the names on the once flat headstones on the section reserved for African-American veterans of foreign wars. The metal rusts. In some cases, the careful symmetry of those who wore uniforms is interrupted by headstones now crooked with the weight of history, although their stone inscriptions say they were placed not long ago. We're coming up on the 100th anniversary of Beechwood Cemetery, founded in 1923 as a public repository for the segregated dead. What does that mean? In addition to being a contemporary burial site, Beechwood is where black people go when they are evicted from what would have been their final homes. That was the original purpose of Beechwood, and generations of ancestors ended up here when they were uprooted from the historic Wolf Den Cemetery, also known as Violet Park, now a parking lot. If you walk around the perimeter of the new smooth parking lot, you'll see headstones and markers intertwined with the roots of the Tweeds. Beechwood is where you went if you were exhumed from the historic Gear Cemetery because the city deemed it overcrowded, and it was one of the repositories for over 1,000 graves, moved from the Crest Street neighborhood to make room for Highway 147. A couple of months ago, I wrote, the cars driving along 147 were driving through ghosts. I didn't know they were literally driving over the soil of displaced graves. How can we think differently about this moment of rapid development and shifting earth? What if we acknowledge that the displacement of black people in Durham is not new, nor is it limited to the living? Even in death, black people have not been able to rest without a fight. Durham let the city's black dead wait half a century before creating a public cemetery. First, Maplewood Cemetery was established in 1872 for Durham's white deceased. And as Polly Murray writes in Proud Shoes, the rifle of a Confederate memorial pointed directly out of that cemetery toward the back of her grandfather's house, where she grew up. But again, we can't only look above ground. More than 100 years ago, Murray's grandfather, a Union Civil War veteran, started complaining to the city that drainage pipes flowed directly onto his property, eroding the foundation of his house. The city ignored him. The water flowing through the decomposed remains of the Confederate dead threatened black housing. So, when it rains, it pours. Over 100 years later, thanks to the work of the Pauli Murray Project, the drainage flow has finally been shifted. Can you imagine the current city government making a developer wait 100 years for infrastructure changes? Or even one? Documentary artist Anthony Patterson grew up in the Crest Street neighborhood, one of the few communities able to mitigate the impact of 147 on their lives. Patterson's research has shown that his community has existed for about as long as Durham has been incorporated. When he was growing up in the wake of highway construction, people would say that he and the other children were playing on the site of unmarked graves. His mother was involved in keeping track of who was where when the highway displaced what Patterson's grandfather says was the central burial ground for black people on the west side. The Crest Street organizers sought to preserve New Bethel Baptist Church, which recently celebrated 140 years, and to continue to attend to those graves as best they could. New Bethel continues to be a site of progressive community building. And across the highway in New Bethel Memorial Gardens, you can see generations headstones put up just this year. Worn headstones that are not engraved but are beautifully embedded with small white stones, and those markers engraved without birth dates, signs of those ancestors whose society suggests were not born but instead made in the crucible of slavery. By contrast, on the other side of the tree line is an abandoned white cemetery where large headstones with some of the city's most prominent slaveholding names are overgrown with thorns, untended for decades. In this moment, when progress seems to flood in one direction, and Durham can't help but be carried away, we should ask the Patterson family, the New Bethel community, the people who insisted on access to each other, to loved ones living and dead, how they held tight to one another's hands and stayed rooted in shifting ground. I, for one, had to pay my respects in that well-tended garden. And now here comes this feature, the good, the bad, and the awful. Good. Snow! The 2 or so inches of snow the Triangle received last Thursday, depending on where you live, was the first we've seen around these parts since December 2018, nearly 14 months ago, and it was just about perfect. It was more than a dusting, but there wasn't too much. The kids got a snow day, the roads weren't iced over for a week, the region only shut down for a morning, and people maintained a reasonable amount of calm, and it all melted by Saturday, when temps were back in the 50s. So, nice work, everyone. Had this storm missed us, 2019-20 would have marked only the 12th winter since 1887, as far back as records go, with no measurable snowfall and, so far as we can tell, the first ever without so much as a trace. Bad. Durham County Government. Last week, the Indy obtained a letter that Durham County Manager Wendell Davis sent Commissioner Heidi Carter on February 11th, accusing her, pretty bluntly, of racism. But there's some context needed here. Carter's up for re-election. A former school board member, she and Davis have battled over school funding. Davis's contract, meanwhile, comes up for renewal next year. If Carter loses, he probably has a better shot at keeping his job. School board chair Mike Lee, who is black, argued that Davis was lodging allegations of racism for political purposes. Carter says Davis's letter contains misquotes and fabrications, and its primary audience was the press. In response to an outcry from Davis supporters at its meeting on Monday night, the Board of Commissioners took steps toward launching an investigation into the matter. And the awful Medlin Mitch McConnell. It's not clear whether the Faith and Power PAC's goal was to actually help Erica Smith win the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate to try to force Cal Cunningham to take more progressive positions than he otherwise would have ahead of the general election, or simply to cause chaos. Nor is it clear whether the PAC's involvement did the job or backfired. It was a huge ad buy. The $3 million Faith and Power has dropped on Smith's behalf is about 10 times what she's raised herself, but it didn't take long for media outlets to figure out that Faith and Power had GOP connections, which allowed Cunningham to claim that incumbent Senator Tom Tillis was scared of him. Tillis denied it, but then last week we learned that Faith and Power is pretty much a pass-through for the Senate Leadership Fund, a super PAC, run by allies of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. So, even if Tillis isn't scared of Cunningham, it sure seems like his boss is. And over to Durham, from Tomasi McDonald, break every chain. In 1994, when Zadie Ari Walker was 10, his father shot and killed the boy's uncle. The way a cousin later explained it, Calvin McLean Moore's father had died and he was supposed to take care of the family farm. He failed to live up to his duties. One day, Calvin's brother Lonnie confronted him. They both had handguns. Lonnie draw first, Calvin fired first, Lonnie died. It was some Cain and Abel crap if I ever heard of it, Walker says. Moore was convicted of manslaughter and spent 4 months in prison. He was released on January 27th of 1995. About a year and a half later, Moore gunned down his brother-in-law. And this time he got 25 years. Walker, a Durham native who lives in Brooklyn, never really knew his father, even before he got locked up. He only met him twice, 2001 at a prison hospital, and on Halloween 2015, a month after Moore's release. Walker, a filmmaker, chronicled the second meeting for a documentary explaining how his fatherless childhood affected his life. "I had a hole in my heart," he says, "this nagging feeling of incompleteness." Across the Marsh, the title refers to a colloquial name for the Farmers Union, that rural community near Lumberton that's home to the Moore family farm, offers a stark reflection on the anger and heartbreak common to boys who grow up without their fathers. It's set against the backdrop of mass incarceration in a city and country engulfed by the crack cocaine epidemic of the 1990s, Durham's deadliest decade. Of the Durham Police Department's 250 unsolved murders, 95 took place during those years. Like too many black kids of his generation, Walker grew up without a father. He went to Durham Academy, but he found a home with the dope pushers in McDougal Terrace. And as he got older, he began to wonder if he was destined for his father's fate. They shared the same blood, after all. Walker, too, was wild and confrontational, and when he got angry, his thoughts turned to violence. Walker never knew his old man, but he couldn't escape him. The first time Walker met Calvin, he always calls him Calvin, his father was a patient at the now-closed McCain Correctional Hospital in Rayford. He'd gotten into an argument with a fellow inmate over a TV. A guard let the other inmate into his cell. The inmate bashed in Calvin's skull with a lock in a sock. The prison wrapped Calvin's head with a wool blanket. When he healed, strands of wool were left in his brain. There, Calvin told his 17-year-old son about that second murder. His sister Loretta's husband was beating her. She wanted to leave him. Calvin went to their place and told them to get out, but the husband told Calvin he'd kill her and him first. Calvin took that as a threat and put a bullet in his head. He put the man's body in the back of his truck, drove to a compost site, and burned the corpse. 6 months later, he was doing cocaine with his girlfriend. They got into an argument. Calvin threatened to kill her, and she ratted him out to the cops. This version probably isn't the whole truth. Walker's mom told him later that Calvin was seen driving around in the victim's truck. His cousin told him the killing was planned. However it happened, Calvin tried to gloss over it. He told his son he was a changed man, that he'd found the Lord. Walker wasn't convinced. "Christian my ass," he remembers thinking. "I was about to yell out, 'Guard, this man is crazy!'" "Every time I tell that story," he adds, "I feel like I'm doing 30 for 30 for like John Wayne Gacy or Charles Manson." Soon after Walker was born, his mother finished her bachelor's degree at Duke. She went to Brown and earned her master's, then returned to Durham to go to NC Central School of Law. Yvette Walker took pains to ensure that her son grew up in a healthy environment. She enrolled him at Durham Academy, a mostly white, affluent private school. They lived in a squat, red brick house on a sloping hill across the street from the law school. At Durham Academy, Walker found himself having to answer the inevitable question asked innocently enough, "Where's your father?" "It was terrifying to answer that question for white people," he says. "I walked around for decades not wanting to talk about it. In the black communities, it's normalized, but the white community feels sorry for you." I would tell them, "No, I'm fine. I have my mommy. She loves me." The Walker's house was just down the street from McDougal Terrace public housing complex. Then, like now, the Mac was rife with drugs and violence. Walker started hanging out there. He could show a side of himself there that no one at the school could see. "I loved the street. I loved the dope boys," Walker says. "The edginess spoke to me. They would ask, 'Who is this light-skinned MF who goes to a private school?' But my boys would say, 'No, he cool.' I'd be thinking to myself, 'I'm crazier than everyone in here.'" Calvin was like a demon lurking inside of him. It's like I lived a double life because of Calvin, he says. When I was at Durham Academy, I didn't talk about Calvin, but when I was in the MAC, playing on the basketball court, that stuff was normal. That was the vibe. And it was like, and so what? I ain't got no daddy either. And didn't nobody care he was in prison for murder. 14 years after the visit in the prison hospital, Walker and his mother drove to Lumberton to meet Calvin for the second time, this time with a cameraman in tow. Walker went to UNC Chapel Hill after graduation, but only lasted a semester. In 2005, he moved to New York, where he discovered a love of acting while studying at the William Esper Studio. He'd made a few attempts at starting this documentary, but the wounds were too raw. With Calvin getting out of prison, though, he took it up in earnest. I wanted to get to know him beyond the murderous villain trope that was playing out in my mind, he says. I wanted to humanize him because all I could feel was the pain and heaviness of not having him in my life. But as he drove to Lumberton, Walker had second thoughts. I don't know what I want from this whole thing anymore, he says in the film. I'm more interested in basically sticking up for that kid who couldn't stick up for himself in terms of where his father has been. They were supposed to meet at a Walgreens, but Calvin wasn't there. Calvin's two sisters were. They drove to their house in Farmers Union and went to the living room. Still no Calvin. Walker, his mother, and the aunts he'd just met walked into a sunny wood-paneled day room filled with potted plants. Walker turned around and saw Calvin talking to his mother. After decades in prison, his father was a broken man, shriveled and gaunt. I went through so much anxiety staring at him, Walker says. I wanted to yell a primal scream. I was enraged. Father and son walked outside, followed by a small, yelping family dog. Calvin wanted to show Walker his new white GMC Sierra, parked under a gray, weather-beaten wooden shed, its chrome rims reflecting the late afternoon sunlight. Calvin asked his son if he wanted to sit in the driver's seat. Walker climbed in and turned on the radio. Patty Drew's Working on a Groovy Thing was playing. Calvin reached over and changed the station. The voice of Tasha Cobbs told listeners there was power in the name of Jesus to break every chain, break every chain, break every chain. Calvin stared at his son and nodded in time with the lyrics. His son did the same. Then Calvin hugged him. I love you, son. Calvin Moore died in that truck the following September. He drove off a highway and crashed. He was pronounced dead in the ambulance. He died alone. In the months that followed, Walker wrestled with the concepts of forgiveness and self-acceptance. He says it was important to no longer internalize his feelings of rejection and to abandon narratives of self-sabotage. He wanted to give back, not only to black boys who grew up without their fathers, but also to white boys, like the ones who attended Durham Academy, whose parents are home, but absent because of 18-hour workdays. He finished the film in January, and he's begun working with a mental health professional to develop an educational curriculum to accompany it. His scars remain, he says, and they're deep. But he's learning to forgive, and that's a gift he wants to share with the world. I want to start the healing process for at least a million teens in single-parent and dysfunctional homes, Walker says. I want to inspire people, young and old, to find forgiveness in their hearts for the shortcomings of their parents. Well, Jeffrey C. Billman, the editor-in-chief here at Indie Week, has written the soap boxer column, The Bloom and the Burn. There are many, many things wrong with Michael Bloomberg's billion-dollar vanity exercise, but there's also one thing he gets right, and it's also the thing that gives me pause about Bernie Sanders' increasingly likely nomination. The issue isn't ideology. On that score, I'm mostly in Bernie's camp. I believe in universal health care and a Green New Deal. I think ICE should be abolished, private prisons banned, wealth should be taxed, coal plants shut down, public schools better funded, public universities free, child care should be publicly supported, and military adventurism should be vastly curtailed. But I also think Donald Trump poses a singular threat to our institutions, and that if he wins, we'll spend four more years sliding towards authoritarianism. So, defeating him is priority one. Bloomington's campaign isn't premised on ideas. The whole thing could be summed up in one sentence. Trump is bad and I can beat him. Let's make one thing emphatically clear. Mike Bloomberg is the absolute wrong person to deliver this message. Bloomberg's history of racist, sexist, transphobic comments is disqualifying. Stop and frisk disqualifying. Trying to literally buy an election is qualifying. Having the plutocrat's hubris to suggest that other candidates drop out before his first debate is disqualifying. Watching Elizabeth Warren disembowel him was fun, but that doesn't mean we should ignore the one thing he accurately intuits. If the election is a referendum on Trump, Trump will lose. Unseating an incumbent is hard under the best circumstances. Only once in the last 100 years has a party lost the White House after one term in power. It's even more difficult when the economy is growing. Any normal president would be favored this year. When GDP is growing at about 2%, we're adding about 200,000 jobs a month, and unemployment is under 4%. But Trump isn't a normal president. He's never had positive approval ratings. He probably never will. Bloomberg's theory, then, is to simply let Trump beat himself. For all of his braggadocio, Trump doesn't want that kind of referendum. He wants an enemy, an outlet for resentment, someone he can make as despised as he is. Any Democrat will be attacked, called a commie, baby killer, the Antichrist, perhaps have Trump's Department of Justice launch an investigation into one of their family members. But Sanders is leading a self-described political revolution. He also has a history of praising aspects of repressive regimes, including the Soviets and the Sandinistas. Just this weekend on 60 Minutes, he threw in some nice words for Fidel Castro's literacy program. So, an election that could be a referendum on Trump will instead be a referendum on domestic socialism, Sanders, and his revolution. That's what Trump wants. It's what Bernie wants, too. Sweeping reforms shouldn't be secondary players. It's not what Democratic Party leaders or Dems in vulnerable congressional districts want. I don't normally find establishment pearl-clutching interesting. For decades, the party has been terrified of its own shadow, even as radicalizing Republicans redefined the political center. But I do worry that Sanders might be the wrong person running the right campaign at the wrong moment. The thing about revolutions or major legislation is that they usually follow national trauma. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments followed the Civil War. The New Deal came amid the Great Depression. The Civil Rights Act followed JFK's assassination. Even the Affordable Care Act followed a global economic collapse. The economy isn't as great as Trump claims, and perhaps it will crash in the next 8 months. Coronavirus fears tanked global stock markets on Monday, but right now we're not there. That's not to say Sanders is unelectable, or the Democrats vying for the moderate lane would be more electable. Sanders can inspire and mobilize in a way that Joe Biden and Mike Bloomberg never will. But I suspect that a campaign focused more on prosecuting Trump's malice, incompetence, and corruption than selling an overhaul of the U.S. economy, while explaining the differences between communism, socialism, and democratic socialism / social democracy, is more apt to succeed. Peter Hamby made a compelling argument for Vanity Fair last month that my concerns are misplaced. What if Sanders is actually the most electable Democrat? In the age of Trump, hyperpartisanship, institutional distrust, and social media, Sanders could be examined as a candidate almost custom-built to go head-to-head with Trump this year. Sanders, Hamby continued, has five things going for him: celebrity, media savvy, a clear message, a fundraising machine, and an army behind him. The last thing is the most essential. Bernie's theory is that he's going to rewrite the playbook, that his movement will inspire young and disenfranchised voters to turn out in record numbers, while his populist message will peel away segments of Trump's coalition. In a close election, which econometric forecasts suggest this will be, a surge of new voters could put Sanders over the top if they're in the right states and if they're not offset by otherwise Trump-wary suburbanites scared off by the S word. This is Bernie's high-stakes gamble. It's also a bet Trump appears eager to take. Then again, Hillary Clinton was eager to run against Donald Trump. Well, this next article from Leah Taus about Erica Smith is quite long, one of the longest articles I've read in my time here at Indie Week. The House always wins. Erica Smith is late. Her empty chair sits on the stage beside three men hoping to challenge Tom Tillis this fall. National Democrats have pinned their hopes on the one to the far left, Cal Cunningham, a 6-foot-tall veteran in a dark gray suit who has, by today, January 25th, already raised north of $3 million. Cunningham looks like a senator, like one you'd order from Central Casting. If you close your eyes and think of the words North Carolina Democrat, something like him probably comes to mind. He's from a small town, served in a war, has a beautiful wife, picture-perfect children, a successful lawyer. He has a winning smile. He's politically non-threatening. Cunningham grips the mic with intention. Though seated, his voice projects loudly to the citizens at the Raleigh Wake Citizens Association's candidate forum, his confidence tangible as he regurgitates sound bites from his by-now familiar commercials, his tone somewhere between that of a minister and a car salesman. "Together this fall, we're going to replace Tom Tillis in the U.S. Senate," he says. He repeats nearly verbatim remarks he gave a few hours earlier at an NAACP forum in Greensboro, how when he served as senior trial counsel in Iraq and Afghanistan, he could never have imagined that the country's greatest threat would come from Washington, D.C. Erica Smith was late to that forum, too. Cunningham finishes. Little-known candidate Steve Swenson goes next, offering a forgettable introduction. He's followed by Mecklenburg County Commissioner Trevor Fuller, who stands to address the crowd. Cunningham appears to take a mental note, wishing he'd done the same. As the candidates spar over the first question from this panel, Erica Smith bursts through the doors in the back of the room and bolts to claim her space on stage. She's in an elegant navy pantsuit, but her style has a certain joyous imperfection. The state senator who's represented North Carolina's rural northeastern edge for the last 5 years asks to be allowed an introduction. With the mic in her hand, her energy consumes the room. Unscripted and jarringly earnest, Smith recounts her journey from Boeing engineer to teacher and preacher, from being raised in eastern North Carolina to working her way up the ranks of the General Assembly. Smith was the first Democrat to enter that race back in January 2019. In June and again in August, she made a pitch to the party's power brokers in D.C., but she says they were noncommittal. She later learned the DSCC had met with Cunningham in May. He got the group's endorsement in October. She says she knew the campaign would be an uphill battle, but her entire life has been an uphill battle. She grew up poor and black. She almost died in childbirth. She watched her youngest son die and her second husband get charged with rape. But she's persevered. Everything she's accomplished, she did herself through grit, determination, and her unassailable brilliance. She was made for the hustle and made from it. At 50, she's learned not to listen to the doubters. There are plenty of doubters. Objectively, there's good reason to doubt. At the end of 2019, Cunningham had an 11-to-1 cash advantage, which has helped him buy TV ads and amass a 27-point lead in the most recent poll. Gary Pierce, former advisor to Governor Jim Hunt, says that to win elections, you need to abide by the 2 M's rule. You need a message, and you need money, and the organization that money buys to get your message out. Smith has the first. Pardon me. She lacks the second. Particularly Democrats, we're idealists, Pierce told me. We like to think money is the root of evil, and it is in a lot of cases, but it's also the only way to get information to people. Smith isn't listening. She's focused on the hustle, swearing off corporate PAC money, driving from forum to forum on a shoestring budget, taking her message to voters one at a time if she has to. The system is broken, she says, especially for women of color, but it doesn't have to be. She's determined to prove that big odds can overcome big money. Let's be honest here, she says. Black women are never going to have the money white men have. We don't earn dollar for dollar. We earn 65 cents on the dollar. As a public school educator, I don't have $50,000 to loan to my campaign. I have truly shown what can be done with a reasonable budget, a reasonable fundraising plan. If you truly want big money out of politics, then you will back a candidate that's based on the merit and the message. But Tillis is vulnerable, and this isn't an election Democratic bigwigs are willing to lose by gambling on an ideological purist. The party, says political consultant Perry Woods, made a, quote, raw calculation who they think can best win. There's a moral imperative. What's on the line, frankly, this year is whether we're going to continue the great American experiment and save our democracy. Smith supporters would counter that while Cunningham is likable, he's not exciting. She's the racist wild card, a candidate willing to buck convention. The question is, how far can a candidate go swimming against the tide? James Calvin Cunningham III grew up in Lexington, population 19,000, the self-proclaimed barbecue capital of the world, where the town hall contains 19th-century brick pits prominently displayed. I love my barbecue, Cunningham says, biting into a bacon, egg, and cheese croissant at a Cafe Carolina a few blocks from his house in Cameron Village. He sprawled out at a table in the back beside his communications manager. A white three-ring binder packed full of notes and research sits open on the table. The oldest of three children, Cunningham says he learned to take responsibility at a young age. He grew up active in the church and mowed lawns on the weekends to save up for his first guitar. He attended Vanderbilt University before transferring to the UNC Chapel Hill, where he studied political science and philosophy. He graduated in 1996, then earned his law degree from the UNC School of Law. Without missing a beat, Cunningham launched into his political career. In 2000, he ran for General Assembly at age 27 and won, but only served one term before redistricting turned his rural district south of Winston-Salem red. After 9/11, Cunningham joined the Army Reserves. In 2007, he shipped out to Iraq to serve as prosecutor, working with the Judge Advocate General's office to weed out misconduct among military contractors. For that work, Cunningham was awarded a Bronze Star and General Douglas MacArthur Leadership Award. He carried a gun, but he never fired it at an enemy. For exercise, he ran around the base in Kuwait. Time moved slowly. In 2010, he returned to the Middle East to serve a second tour in Afghanistan, a country he describes as even more desolate and primitive. At least in Kuwait, he says, there was a McDonald's. Of North Carolina's major cities, Cunningham's most likely to meet resistance in Durham. In 2013, he represented a controversial luxury housing development known as 751 South. The city and county governments tried to block it. Cunningham, however, leaned on his relationship with future House Speaker Tim Moore, a law school friend, to get the General Assembly to force the city to provide water and sewer to that project. Cunningham's pitch to Democrats is straightforward. He can beat Tom Tillis, a former state House Speaker who narrowly defeated Senator Kay Hagan 6 years ago, but is now one of the least popular incumbents in the country. Tillis ran promising to be an independent voice, but he's bound himself to President Trump, hoping the coattails are long enough to pull him over the finish line. Tillis's inevitable efforts to paint his opponent as a wild-eyed socialist won't work on him, Cunningham says, no matter who's atop the Democratic ticket. He's more moderate than Erica Smith on issues like health care and climate crisis. He wants a public option, not Medicare for all. He's been an environmental lawyer, but he hasn't signed on to the Green New Deal. He voted for Pete Buttigieg, a fellow veteran, not Bernie Sanders. He'll appeal to the suburbs, not play to the base. He's not running to spark a revolution, but to restore dignity. Today, he tells me it's his daughter's 18th birthday. Yes, she's registered to vote. And she's responsible for his decision to run for office. Lieutenant governor at first, then U.S. Senate. One morning last year, as the family was getting ready for school, she heard someone on television talking about one of Trump's late-night Twitter rants. Suddenly, his normally reserved daughter pointed at the TV. So, what are you going to do about it, Dad? Cunningham tells this story a lot. He tells a lot of stories a lot. There's nothing Cunningham tells me he hasn't told thousands of potential voters already. save perhaps that an admission that he loves the Grateful Dead. He is careful and disciplined. He knows the script and sticks to it. He's also very intelligent and very organized, and his campaign is a well-oiled machine. While we finish breakfast, a gaggle of staffers is already driving to Greensboro, where Cunningham would address the NAACP in a few hours. We leave in time to arrive early. His communications manager takes the wheel of a silver Jeep Compass, and Cunningham assumes the front seat. I ask questions to the back of his head. He leafs through the white three-ring binder. I ask if he color coordinates all his binders. No, he replies. His binders are always white. I ask why. White's for the good guys. I've never rethought it. Erica Smith is late. Her black and gray poncho is slung over the stall door of the Sheets bathroom. She shuffles inside, changing into evening wear. I change in gas stations all the time, she says. She has no gaggle of advanced staff, no communications manager to drive her, no staff photographer snapping pictures everywhere she goes, no white three-ring binders. Her campaign is often her and her identical twin, Alicia, who hates politics but loves her sister, as well as a campaign manager and some volunteers who may or may not show up when needed. She's always rushing. There's always chaos. Today, February 8th, is no different. We were supposed to head to Alicia's house in Durham so Smith could change before driving to Charlotte, where she'll deliver a keynote to the nation's oldest black sorority, Delta Sigma Theta. But we lingered too long at the HCON rally in Raleigh, so the Sheets off Miami Boulevard will have to do. Smith's car, a red Toyota Venza hatchback, is a mobile closet full of dress pants, blouses, dresses, and shoes. Alicia rummages through the trunk as Smith emerges from the gas station in a sparkly red dress suit and bright blue sneakers. Smith flings stilettos onto the pavement as she puts mismatched heels on her stocking feet and asks which pair matches the dress. This is real, people, Smith laughs. A real democracy. They go with taupe. Alicia and Erica were born in Fort Bragg to a military family and moved to the Philippines and then Texas before eventually settling on a farm in Gaston, where the girls spent summer waking up in the dark to pick cucumbers for the farmer's market. The family wasn't well off. They needed the money. After high school, Erica and Alicia attended North Carolina A&T State University and earned engineering degrees. Erica moved to Seattle to work for Boeing after graduation, and 4 years later, followed her husband to Washington, D.C., where she got a job with the U.S. Patent Office. She married, had two children, and divorced, moving back to Gaston to care for her ailing father, while continuing to commute several hours a day to the Patent Office. Sick of the commute, she started teaching math in Virginia public schools. She married and divorced again. She earned a master's degree in divinity from Howard University and got ordained. Following her first divorce, she adventured into politics. In 2006, she unsuccessfully ran for the school board in Northampton County, then ran again and won 2 years later. She'd been mapping out her next step, the state senate, since 2005, but really, it had been a dream since childhood. In 2014, she made her move, challenging Republican incumbent Clark Jenkins. It was a GOP-friendly year, but she won a Republican-leaning district by 8 points. Despite working in a Republican supermajority, she was named Freshman Senator of the Year in 2016. She started thinking about moving up again. She set her eyes on the U.S. Senate. It hasn't been a smooth ride. During her first year in the legislature, her second husband, Maude Ingram, was indicted on rape charges. Smith doesn't like to talk about it, out of respect for the victims, she says. When I asked her how it affected her, she deflects. We kept our eyes focused on our work and the community we served and raising my family and getting us through that crisis, Smith said. I never pause to think about how I feel and how it affects me because the priority is the other people who were impacted by this, whose lives were devastated. She did the only thing she knew how to do. She kept going. She'd done it before, when she'd met tragedy. During her third pregnancy, Smith suffered from hypertension. At the end of her second trimester, tests showed the baby was in distress. Her doctor asked her who she wanted to save, her or the baby. At 37, Smith decided she was prepared to die. Despite the odds, Elias was born at 24 weeks, weighing just over 1 pound, but he suffered a cranial bleed and had to be given a tracheostomy due to his prematurity. And so began Smith's agonizing year-long battle with her insurance company, which refused to cover a component for the trach tube and initially denied her request for an in-home aid. It only ended when Elias died in 2012 at the age of 5. But Smith didn't give in to anger or sadness. There are people all over this nation who go through worse, and every day they have to fight their way to get up. I've always had a strong support system and a positive outlook on life, Smith says. It's not what happens to you, it's how you respond and how you keep moving forward. Smith is funny and down to earth, smart and quirky. She looks you in the eyes and makes you feel seen. There was a fundraiser scheduled for her after her speech in Charlotte, but Smith hears there's a power outage, so she cancels it. Raising money isn't her top priority, she says. As I write this, Smith says she's raised $275,000, mostly from small donors, $5 or $10 at a time. We're already 20 minutes late to the sorority event when snow starts to speckle the windshield. Alicia starts to worry. Erica puts on headphones and meditates her pre-speech ritual. The chaos never phases her. Cunningham wasn't Chuck Schumer's first choice, or second, or third. The Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee courted State Senator Jeff Jackson, former State Senator Eric Mansfield, and former Treasurer Janet Cowell before it glanced in Cunningham's direction. Jackson would later say he turned the party down because he didn't want to spend 16 months in a windowless basement dialing donors for money to run attack ads on Tillis. To hear Cunningham tell us, the DSCC didn't recruit him at all. In the spring of 2019, he was traveling the state campaigning for lieutenant governor, but the people he met asked him to take on Tillis instead. Every time I was having a conversation, and invariably, and I can say this with almost no exception, why aren't you offering to run against Tom Tillis? It was over and over and over again, Cunningham says. It just took off, and it made sense, and it was never about anything else. Like so much of what Cunningham says, the story has a canned, almost robotic quality to it. But no matter whose idea it was to party officials running out of options, Cunningham and the $500,000 he'd already raised, including $200,000 he'd loaned himself, was increasingly attractive. The DSCC knew him, too. The party had backed him in 2010, where he challenged Elaine Marshall in a messy Senate primary. Marshall came out 9 points ahead, but didn't secure a majority. Cunningham called for a runoff. Marshall crushed him, winning by 20. But she had to spend time and money doing it. Time and money that could have gone toward battling Richard Burr, to whom the now Secretary of State lost handily. Marshall got no help from the DSCC. Thomas Mills is still salty about that. I have a lot of resentments against them, says Mills, a Democratic consultant who ran Marshall's campaign. Had the DSCC not pushed that primary, Elaine might have had a lot more money, and they might have been putting more money into the race behind us. In June, Cunningham announced he was abandoning his lieutenant governor campaign to run for Senate. By July, it was clear the party was in his corner. Out-of-state donations poured in, donations maxed out. In October, the DSCC made it official, formally endorsing Cunningham's campaign. Smith issued a blistering response. This endorsement cuts to the integrity and ethics of this election. If the DSCC had been involved all along, then it should disclose the details of his prior involvement to the voters of North Carolina. Ultimately, the voters of North Carolina will decide who their next United States Senator will be, not a handful of D.C. politicians making backroom deals in windowless basements. The DSCC, Smith says, has a history of not endorsing black candidates and not backing women. Progressives have sharply criticized the party's involvement in a state that, not counting judicial races, has only elected one black person to a statewide position. The party's decision couldn't help but be seen through a racial prism. Indeed, earlier this month, civil rights leader the Reverend William J. Baker II blasted the party on Twitter for picking a candidate in the primary. But Mills thinks the DSCC was simply being pragmatic. This is a race Democrats need to win to take back the Senate, and they looked at Smith and saw a campaign and a candidate that wasn't ready for prime time. 3 months after Smith entered the race in January 2019, she'd raised just $21,000 to the DSCC. That's a red flag. It costs about $40,000 a month to run a large-scale statewide political operation. The only reason to get into a race that early is to clear the field, Mills says, and you do that by showing you can raise the money and you can put together the organization. Had she done those things, she would have been a strong contender. To win statewide, Democrats need high African-American turnout and for suburban women to break their way. With the right message, Smith could likely deliver both. You could make an argument strongly that Eric would be better on the ticket to turn out votes, Woods says. More minorities and low-information voters may be more willing to show up to vote for Erica than for Cal. But he adds, Erica has not demonstrated the ability to raise the money it's going to take. It's sad, but it's where we are. In February, TV ads went up all over the state praising Smith for her commitment to the Green New Deal and Medicare for All, spliced with a picture of progressive darling Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She was the real deal, the black narrator said. The race is only proven progressive. But the ads didn't come from the Smith campaign. Instead, they came from a brand new PAC called Faith and Power, which media outlets quickly learned had ties to the Trump campaign and the Republican National Committee. Last week, The Hill reported Faith and Power was funded by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's super PAC. Smith disavowed the ads, but it didn't matter. The message, according to Cunningham, was clear. Tillis was afraid of him, so Republicans were trying to prop up a weaker adversary. It probably illustrates the stakes that they see that Tom Tillis is extraordinarily weak, very vulnerable, and that their best play is to cause mischief, Cunningham says. We're wise to it, and we're on alert that there will be more to come. In response, Cunningham upped his own ad buy. He already has PACs working on his behalf. The Vote Vets Action Fund has shelled out more than $6 million so far, while Carolina Blue has spent $1.1 million promoting Cunningham. He has little reason to be concerned. The most recent poll from Public Policy Polling has him besting Smith, 45-18. Somehow, we arrive at the Crown Plaza Hotel in Charlotte at precisely 2 p.m., late, but in time for Smith to give her keynote address to Delta Sigma Theta. As we enter the banquet hall, we're greeted by a sea of crimson dresses. As frenzied as the day has been, everything worked out. The same was true with the RWCA event. She came late, but she got the group's endorsement. This sort of serendipity lends itself to faith, and Smith has that in abundance. Her speech is a rousing sermon on the urgency of the moment. She is sick of waiting for the patriarchy to give her the green light. Rosa Parks didn't wait. Shirley Chisholm didn't wait. Erica Smith isn't going to wait. She's bitter at the DSCC. Bitter the party interfered. The party elites tried to erase her. They chose a white man over a black woman. But damned if she's going to let that stop her. She's never listened to doubters before. She's not going to start now. We cannot wait another day, Smith tells the crowd, until we have a voice that looks like us, understands us, has been through our struggles, been through our troubles. We don't need to wait another day. I believe we have time for a couple of music short articles, one by Charlie Aaron about King Lero. Rock and roll spews out a few big, beautiful emotions really well, and most of them are related to whether or not you're having sex. In the indie alternative cosmos of the 1990s, inchoate frustration was the rock emotion du jour. Launching a long national tour at Cat's Cradle last Friday, Archers of Loaf showed why they, perhaps more than any other local band besides Superchunk, with apologies to Polvo, Dish, Motocaster, Finger, et al., incited sane people to hype the Triangle as, quote, the next Seattle, i.e., the nation's most promising wellspring of rebellious youth soundtrack whoop-de-doo. The Loaf was and is inchoate frustration incarnate. It's their métier. but singer-guitarist Eric Bachman, guitarist Eric Johnson, bass Matt Gentling, and drummer Mark Price now lurch, churn, thud, and get on their metaphorical knees without the slapdash smear of sound that plagued them 20 or 25 years ago. Bachman's gnomic sentence fragment lyrics range narrowly from annoyed to stymied, but within that tight space, his haunted, dry-roasted bellow somehow tracks an entire life cycle of frustration, personal, collective, or both, from simmer to boil to explosion to exhaustion. I missed the band's 2011-12 shows in support of Merge's Records reissues of their four remastered albums, but while facing a teeming crowd of a certain age, plus some curious under-30s, the foursome made an authoritative roar. Their early bro-ish goofiness was not missed. It was the first time I'd ever imagined the band commanding more than a club stage. They tore through their ornery catalog with a moxie of dudes who were finally able to inhabit the power of their racket. It was exhilarating from start to finish. Highlights. Raleigh Days from their upcoming Merge album of new songs was a brisk, wistful blast that sounded wiser, but no less gritty than their original tirades. Wrong and Might from their 1993 debut album, Icky Metal, inspired immediate pogoing. The first captures the epic struggle of two people very sarcastically lit, very earnestly telling each other to screw off, while the second is one self-loathing person trying to write a song for another. Bachman's lyrical gift is for the overwrought, the nonsense proclamations that frustrated humans tend to blurt. They can emerge out of a shambly, discordant lull like a scrap of pointy dialogue from stray gripes. Strike up the band, turned up the random, calling out to the A&R, as lowest part is free would have it, to much-quoted maxims, especially, the underground is overcrowded, from the greatest of all time. That was once heard as a commentary on underground rock's transformation into a chum bucket for major label alt-rock sharks. Now, who knows? Is the underground still overcrowded? What's the underground? That line might as well be about the sweltering bodies swarming London's subway. The world has changed, but archers haven't, and these days you can find frustration wherever you look. Maybe this second comeback is right on time. And about the same group, Brian Howe writes, Slicing the Loaf. Raleigh Days is Archers of Loaf's first new song in more than 20 years, but only the lyrics let on that any tune, any time has passed. Singer Eric Bachman still sounds like he might headbutt you. Guitarist Eric Johnson still seems one reckless string bend away from pitching headlong off the stage. Not only is this the careening, scorch-marked Archers of yore, it's pitched at a nostalgic frequency that only longtime locals will hear. Archers helped make the Chapel Hill indie rock sound a national craze in the 1990s as the last solid days of print media, both high-toned and Xeroxed. So it seems almost perverse that a decade of reunion shows dedicated to their 90s Chapel Hill classics, they would return with a song about Raleigh. Archers isn't much of a band for lyrical exegesis. Fans have spent decades mumbling through indecipherable words that made even less sense when you look them up. See, Lero, you're a hole. And that rough-hewn surrealism continues here until you get to the shout-along chorus. Raleigh Days from the Fallout Shelter stage. Heard you scream, you're going to be somebody someday, Bachman blurtles. It's the emotional key to a song about moving forward by looking back. In Raleigh, where Flex nightclub now stands, there once was a venue called the Fallout Shelter, where all the young rock bands played as the punk shows of the 80s gave way to the A&R scout feasts of the 90s. In that last flash of record label excess, music journalist David Menconi remembers the venue as the site of an insane bidding war over local band Motorola, later Motocaster. In an interview with me some years ago, Superchunk and Merge's Mac McGowan ranked it alongside the Cradle and the Brewery in importance at the time. If Arches of Loaf invocation of the little documented venue is an Easter egg for locals, it's also a reminder that the legend of Chapel Hill was largely a media concoction and that Raleigh and Durham played major roles in indie rock's creation myth. Though Archer's chorus might be directed at any band they saw striving at the fallout shelter, it might also be directed at themselves 30 years ago when they stood on that stage about to be swept up in the post-Nirvana indie feeding frenzy. Courted by major labels, they were stuck in a bad contract with the indie alias. Are they somebody now that it's someday? They made all of their music in 10 years, then nursed a fan base that can sell out the Cradle for 20 more. It might not be the career they'd have imagined then, but it's a legacy, and with new songs emerging at last, the band appears primed for a meaningful second act. By the way, blortle is a word I made up specifically to describe Bachman's singing. It's something between a blurt and a chortle. Okay, just a moment or two to mention a couple of food and beverage-related things coming on over the weekend, Sunday, both on Sunday, and the Dirty Bull and Brewing Company, Broadway in Durham, an independent local craft beer festival, 12 of the best local breweries. And there are tickets can be found at Indie Beer Fest. And the phone number, 919-688-2337. Also on Sunday at the Locals Oyster Bar on East Davie and Raleigh, Winter Seafood Jubilee. A host of experts will be on hand to answer questions about North Carolina seafood. There'll be oyster steaming and fish frying, too. And the event will be followed on Monday by the 8th Annual North Carolina Catch Summit, held at the Transfer Company Food Hall. Whoa. Here come our strolling musicians, Ethel and Raoul, with his grand piano, signaling the end of this reading of Indie Week. The program will appear on our website as a podcast after the initial playing. North Carolina Reading Service, formerly the Triangle Radio Reading Service, provides these programs for blind and print-impaired listeners. I'm John Federson, and I will return next week, whether it's from Jungle Putt Studios or in some different location. So long for now.